In the coming week, world leaders convene virtually for the Global Health Summit. U.S. President Biden and South Korean President Moon meet at the White House, and the U.N. Security Council discusses prospects for Syria amid the presidential election. It's May 20th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, tomorrow, May 21st, world leaders from G20 member states and beyond are set to gather virtually for the Global Health Summit 2021. This year's Global Health Summit is organized by Italy, the current chair of the Group of 20, in partnership with the European Commission. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi and the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, will co-host the summit and are expected to hold a joint press conference. But to start, tell us more about this summit, Bob.
Jim, the summit focus at this point is on what's going to be called the Rome Declaration. This is supposed to be a set of principles that the leaders are going to adopt or supposed to adopt that provides a series of commitments on global health. Principle among them, or the item most focused right now, is a commitment to ramping up of vaccines internationally. In particular, they're going to be looking for what the Rome Declaration says about the licensing of COVID-19 vaccine patents. Right now, according to reports that are showing some leaked versions of the Rome Declaration, there's a calling for a voluntary licensing of COVID-19 vaccine patents to be manufactured in developing countries rather than the waiving of these patents, which the U.S. has called for to distribute shots. So there continues to be this impasse between major developed countries over just waiving this. And there's a great deal of discussion about what waiving of these patents gets you. But we should say this meeting is happening. It's G20. So it's really the representation of the world's leading economy, but also the most populous countries in the world, and a number of countries that are still struggling with COVID-19, and countries that are coming out of it, seemingly. So you have India taking part, which has just recorded the highest ever daily death toll, official death toll of something like 4,500 deaths, which is seen to be a vast undercounting, and still dealing with, you know, a serious crisis caused by this variant of COVID-19. But you also have the United States, you have European countries that are, you know, moving forward with plans to open up their economies, to end lockdowns, to allow tourists to come in and so forth. So you're going to have this, I think the biggest thing to look for is the extent to which there can be common cause met by the G20 leaders and some sort of path forward on ramping up the distribution of vaccines, whether or not it is some sort of easing of patent rights, or there's just going to be a bigger commitment. There has been some pledges we've seen in recent days, including from the United States, to distribute more vaccines, but I think people are going to be looking for more.
Bob, can we go back to the patent protection question? As you note, President Biden announced that the United States supports waiving the patent protections on these vaccines. That was a shift in U.S. policy, but because it has to go through the World Trade Organization, which operates on the basis of consensus, the administration's decision doesn't change anything immediately. And there was some resistance, particularly in Europe, to waiving the patent protections. Can you just fill us in a little bit more about who specifically is unwilling to go along with the Biden administration's call for waiving the patents?
Yes, Jim. It's countries, unsurprisingly, that have large pharmaceutical concerns, or big pharma, as they're known. And so, again, it's a number of EU countries. That includes Germany. And also, I think Australia is among the countries. I think France is also among the countries. And the argument that they're making, and you're seeing this in other places, you're seeing even magazines like The Economist and so forth saying that, you know, this might be a feel-good gesture, but practically, it's not going to get you what you need. And it could actually mitigate against companies doing the efficient work of ramping up productions and also plowing more research into variants that are causing great concern. I'm not sure the legalities and the fine points of whether or not that is true, Jim, but this is partly a line that large pharmaceutical companies are pressing. And they're also saying, look, we are sharing technology across the board in all sorts of ways to ramp up production. And again, The Economist reports something like in 200 cases or so, they have done this, big pharmaceutical companies. So that's one of the issues. And so I think you're going to see a little bit of the debate about the merits and the practical effect of waiving the patents. It has been acknowledged by most sides that even waiving the patents, you're still looking at up to 6 months or so for countries that might get access to these patents to be able to actually create the vaccines and distribute them and so forth. So there's that. But as you say, WTO also operates on consensus. And, you know, we're not close to consensus. I don't think it's just the countries that I mentioned, but they are the main factors in this because you have a large number of developing countries who have yet to see any vaccines or barely a trickle, who are eager for some sort of opening to transpire. As we've talked about in this podcast before, Jim, though, it's not just patent issues. It's material used in distributing and creating vaccines. The U.S. under Defense Production Act has been holding sort of tight to the reins of some of the supplies that go out. India, sort of in the throes of this COVID crisis right now, has stopped producing vaccines, and it is one of the world's major vaccine production
centers. Well, it's continuing to produce. It has stopped the export of vaccines.
Yes, that's right. India stopped the export, and it's relied on for tens of millions of these. So you're not seeing that take place. And it's a question of, as I think some of the watchdog groups and human rights organizations like Amnesty International is saying, that less developed countries are not going to receive enough doses to receive widespread coverage at current pace until like 2023. We have seen some revisions on estimates and projections and models throughout this case, including with the initial vaccines themselves, Jim. So I'm not sure whether that figure is true, but there is a lot of worry as Asia in particular, and Southeast Asia, South Asia in particular, deal with a virulent surge of COVID-19 and variants. There's real concern that vaccines are going to lag, and somehow there's going to be a vaccine sort of defiant strain of the virus that takes hold. And you could see this thing seesaw back and forth again, which has been sort of the pattern of COVID as it started.
You're certainly right, Bob. I know there's a lot of concern about this variant that has emerged in India, the so-called B.1.617.2 variant, that it may be more transmissible and is passed along much more easily, but it may also be more resistant to the vaccine. So I think that's going to be something important to watch, because this variant has already begun to show up around the world because we live in a world of global travel. I know that the British are seeing signs of the Indian variant showing up, not just in London, but in parts of northern England as well. So I think this is something to watch, because certainly here in the United States, there's a lot of optimism. We've licked COVID. Life's going to go back to normal. And I'll note that the Indian government thought that back in February and was quite surprised by what has been happening in the last month or so.
It's true, Jim. And there's kind of a knock-on effect here. Every day, we're kind of learning something new about the patterns of this and the patterns of what vaccination get you. There are reports in the last 24 hours or so that Mexico has seen a sharp reversal in its negative COVID trends. And they're attributing some of it to what they call the Biden wall, which is the ramp up of vaccination in the United States and what that's meant for any sort of transmission south of the U.S. border into Mexico. Now, it's not clear whether or not that's true, but it's undeniable Mexico is in a positive trend mode. But again, Asia is in a negative mode. And now we're seeing Malaysia enter into lockdown. Singapore has just canceled the big Shangri-La dialogues that it hosts. Japan is holding tight to its Summer Olympics, but it's looking ever more kind of perilous there as they continue to wrestle with the infection rates. So we're dealing in a very unbalanced world right now, Jim, and a very uneven pace of vaccination. But Jim, I want to turn our attention to another set of important talks happening in the coming week. In fact, just tomorrow, this will be the South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who is set to meet with President Biden at the White House. Now, he's only the second world leader after Japan's Prime Minister Suga to meet with Biden in person at the White House. What's on the agenda for these talks, Jim?
Well, Bob, the big issue hovering over the meeting, whether it's on the formal agenda or not, is China. It's no accident that President Moon and Prime Minister Suga have been the first two world leaders to visit the White House. President Biden has said from the get-go that China is foreign policy job one for his administration. And a big part of that goal is reinvigorating U.S. alliances. Now, as with Japan, the question of how to deal with China is a sensitive subject with South Korea. After all, the South Koreans live in China's neighborhood. China is their main trading partner. And like Japan, the South Koreans have been the target of Chinese economic pressure in the past. Indeed, South Korean concerns about offending China may even be greater than Japan's, where Japan is a member of the so-called Quad, that is the United States, Australia, India, and Japan. The South Koreans aren't. I think the sense in Seoul is the South Koreans want to avoid poking the dragon in the eye. But at the same time, I think we're seeing real evolution in South Korean public attitudes. Now, historically, there's been a portion of the South Korean electorate that's been angry at the United States, a bit of anti-Americanism, and also harboring, I think, a great deal of sympathy for China and having great hopes that South Korea and China can work out some mutual accommodation. But I'll note that the Chicago Council has just released a survey that's found that more and more Koreans view China as a security threat more than a potential security partner, and more of an economic threat than an economic partner. Indeed, three out of every Secretary for Korean surveyed said that the U.S. military presence in the region actually increases regional stability. So I think that's going to be a backdrop in these conversations. And I'll say that, you know, when Biden and Moon sit down, there'll be other specific issues on their agenda: North Korea, COVID-19, U.S.-South Korea, Japan coordination, and probably a bit of talk about semiconductor supply chains. We've realized over the last year or two that semiconductors are in many ways the lifeblood of the modern economy, and semiconductor manufacturing is concentrated in a few places, most notably Taiwan. We often talked about concerns about Taiwan's future and potential for China to try to coerce Taiwan to rejoin the mainland and what that might produce. I should also note there's a fair amount of symbolism attached to Moon's visit. He is going to go to Arlington National Cemetery to pay tribute to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. He's also going to attend a groundbreaking ceremony for the Wall of Remembrance that's going to be built at the Korean War Veterans Memorial. And President Biden is going to award his first Medal of Honor this weekend, and he is going to do it to a veteran of the Korean War. Moon will be attending the ceremony. So again, a great deal of symbolism surrounding their conversation, all aimed at emphasizing the length of the U.S.-South Korean partnership and the shared sacrifices citizens of the two countries have made along the way.
I should just kick off by noting my own personal taste for war memorials. The Korean one, I think, is one of my favorites in a way. It hits me unlike some of the other ones, and it's particularly moving memorial. So it'd be interesting to see that as part of the events playing out, Jim. But I want to stay with the issue of the military alliance, because it was an area where, characteristically, the Trump administration turned the screws on South Korea to work out a new sort of basing agreement and payment structure, shall we say, for U.S. forces being based in South Korea. That seems to have been all but completed as Biden took office. Is that right?
Yes, that was one of the things the Biden administration negotiated very early on. They came to agreement with the South Koreans. The United States is getting paid more than it was in the past, but nowhere near the 5 times increase that was associated with President Trump, and that was a non-starter from the get-go. And so that issue, that irritant in U.S.-South Korean relations, has been removed and put to the side.
But the other looming issue of North Korea has reached a different phase. You had these extraordinary images during the Trump administration of North Korean leader Kim and President Trump sort of making history in where they met, and the sort of gloss on their meetings didn't seem to lead to much at the end of the day. A bit of a return to, not to say strategic patience, as it was called, but another tone between Biden and Kim. Do you see Moon delivering any message about any sort of urgency on the North Korean sort of military or threat front?
Well, there's certainly urgency for President Moon. He's entering the final year of his presidency. He had hoped that his term would see a fundamental change in the nature of the relationship between South Korea and North Korea. That hasn't happened. As you note, President Trump, you know, tried a different play in the playbook to see if he could jumpstart that conversation. That did not produce any of the promised results. And we're continuing with a problem that has been around for a while, which is North Korea has nuclear weapons. Its ability to deliver those weapons through ballistic missiles is getting better and better with time. And I think, quite honestly, people are out of fresh ideas of how to deal with North Korea. It's pretty clear that the North Koreans are not going to denuclearize. And so the question is, if you start talks with the North Koreans, what are you actually going to discuss with them? I know that President Moon is hopeful that he can persuade President Biden to reopen talks or restart talks with North Korea. But again, it's hard to see where this is going to go, because the North Koreans have communicated, I think, very clearly that for them, keeping nuclear weapons is non-negotiable. They're not going to give them up.
This leads me back then to the China question you teed up at the beginning, Jim. So China seemingly has sort of improved its leverage in its relationship with North Korea. We'll still see where that leads, but that seems to be the case. But more broadly, China is a looming presence in the region. Are we going to see any sort of common statement about China, or is that asking for too much in this meeting between Moon and Biden?
That's what we're going to find out when the meeting concludes. People who are Korea experts and China experts are going to pore over that communique. They're going to parse it with immense care, trying to figure out whether something new is being said here. And that gives you a sense of, you know, how the diplomacy of all of this works, where changing an adjective here or there or using a particular phrase rather than some other phrase can be read to convey something of significance. But again, we're not going to know about that until the meeting wraps up.
Okay, well, in the meantime, we'll mark another face-to-face meeting in this unusual reemergence from COVID.
Let's talk about a different part of the world, Bob, namely Syria. The Syrians are scheduled to hold a presidential election. This is largely a symbolic exercise. It's pretty clear that Syria's current president, Bashar al-Assad, who has been chosen to run along with two other men by Syria's Supreme Constitutional Court, is going to be declared the winner. But taking all of that into account, can you just lay out for us what's happening in Syria these days?
Yes, Jim. For one, it's interesting to be talking about Syria these days, especially when there are other parts of the Middle East, namely on the Israeli-Palestinian front, that are dominating attention, and rightfully so. But Syria, 10 years into its civil war, is potentially reaching a bit of an end phase. And part of that, at least according to Syrian authorities and their backers in Russia in particular, involves an election process. So this is the fourth time Assad is running for a seven-year term. He's allowed to run twice under the new constitution that Russia helped broker under a UN-facilitated process. And it, as you say, it's symbolic. There's no chance he's going to lose. But they are trying to put a big show of this out there, that there is actually a vote taking place. They're even sort of making a big point of getting the many Syrians who are refugees in Lebanon to vote. There's something like a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. And so they are turning out to vote. They are in a vulnerable position right now, because if they don't, if they show sort of open defiance to Assad, then, you know, they could face all sorts of repercussions, or their families could, and so forth. So it's a vote in which Syria is placing stock, in which Russia to some extent is taking stock. And that's important for the other thing that's taking place in the coming week, Jim, which is the UN Security Council sort of having its updated discussion of both the political and the humanitarian situation in Syria. Now, the Assad government controls most of Syria now, except for a little enclave near Idlib in the north, but it remains a country devastated by war, still about half of its population either displaced internally or as refugees. Economy is in shambles. And so, you know, what does that mean for the UN Security Council? Well, among other things, the UN Security Council will decide on trying to open up corridors for aid to come in through, still very aid dependent. And will it give its blessing to the political process that has produced these presidential votes? There's also supposed to be parliamentary votes coming up, which are also expected to be stage managed by the regime. Now, the Biden administration and some of the European members of the council do not favor this approach. They are not expected to give their blessing to it. That's going to create another bit of a standoff between the permanent five veto-wielding members of the Security Council in particular, Jim, who have been at odds over Syria for a while, and it's produced all sorts of problems. It's helped sort of exacerbate humanitarian problems. It's slowed the response to the use of chemical weapons. There still hasn't been a real strong reckoning with the use of chemical weapons, which has been well documented against civilians in Syria by the regime. And so we're looking at, to put it mildly, a tense exchange in the Security Council regarding Syria's political fate, which is supposed to be part of the end game, which is supposed to be part of sort of acknowledging Assad as the legitimate ruler of this country, elected ruler, re-elected ruler, and the international community, will it then get behind his efforts in terms of supporting through UN materiel, going beyond the support that he has gotten from Iran and Russia, and supporting the reconstruction of a country absolutely leveled by civil war?
Bob, you mentioned at the top of your discussion that it was interesting me talking about Syria rather than talking about what has been happening in Israel and Gaza. But let me ask you about that. Is the fighting that we're seeing between the Israelis and Hamas having any spillover impact for the Syrians, either by allowing the Syrians to fly under the radar or creating any kinds of pressure perversely on the Syrian government?
I haven't seen evidence of either of those. It does stand to reason that there is going to be ability to fly under the radar at this period of time. It's still a little bit early, although it's been almost 2 weeks now of Israeli-Hamas confrontations taking place in Israel and the occupied territories. But you have the greater dynamic of Israel's concern about Syria being a staging point for Iranian-backed forces such as Hezbollah. And so I think there's going to be a great deal of attention that Iran not gain a foothold in Syria. I think the other thing that's interesting about the discussions, though, regarding Syria, regarding the government's, you know, behavior on the human rights front and everything else, is that countries on the council, some of which are U.S. allies, have been frustrated with the U.S. for blocking statements, you know, calling for an end to the fighting between Israel and the Hamas forces in Gaza. They're basically saying that, you know, the U.S. is only willing to go so far, and it's sort of supporting sharing of rights and humanitarian purposes and so forth. So there is a spillover in terms of the broader discussion about what the administration is willing to, you know, as it sort of sets in motion its policies and its sort of values-based human rights policy vis-a-vis the Syrian regime, vis-a-vis Iran, and also Israel now.
But overall, the terrible humanitarian situation in Syria is going to persist.
Yeah. Again, the talks you're going to see next week, which will get overshadowed by the symbolic presidential vote, are going to be really important because the latest report from the United Nations says something like 13 million Syrians require humanitarian aid and that their economic losses are in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So there is a need for aid corridors to be open, and those aid corridors are made available through UN auspices. And then the material itself is coming from usually, you know, Western financed and, you know, sort of the major donor democracies that provide food and shelter to Syrians. And that's going to be held hostage if there's some sort of a big political dust up taking place in the Security Council. And Jim, there's some spillover from the UN Security Council actors and our figure of the week, our audience figure of the week. And again, regarding our audience figure of the week, listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. We had a Twitter poll this week with our audience, and they selected Blinken and Lavrov meet. I think I know what that's about, Jim, but can you tell us why that is significant?
Happy to, Bob. The audience picked the fact that the top U.S. and Russian diplomats met for the first time yesterday. They did so in Reykjavik. The two were in the Icelandic capital for a meeting of the Arctic Council, and they used the opportunity to hold a bilateral conversation. Of course, this is not the first time that Reykjavik has hosted the two sides. The city is the site of the famed Reagan-Gorbachev meeting back in 1986, where the two leaders nearly came to an agreement to eliminate all nuclear weapons. Nothing quite so cosmic was on the table in this week's talk. It was more a mutual feeling out. The meeting didn't produce any significant breakthroughs or agreements, and it is doubtful that any were intended or expected. The two diplomats probably did make some progress on setting the agenda for when Biden and Putin meet next month. And at the end, we got the usual diplo speak. The conversations were described as being constructive. The most notable thing about the public portion of the meeting is that as tense as U.S.-Russian relations have been recently, think the saber-rattling over Ukraine, the issue of Alexei Navalny, the various cyber hacks, the tone of the Blinken-Lavrov exchange was reasonably upbeat. Certainly nothing like the testy meeting that Blinken had with top Chinese diplomats in Anchorage back in March. That's not to say that Blinken and Lavrov pretended all is well in the relationship. Blinken acknowledged that it's no secret that we have our differences at Moscow, and he repeated that Washington will respond to aggressive acts by Russia. Lavrov, for his part, likewise noted serious differences between the two countries, but both diplomats made a point to say that the two countries need to find ways to work together, even in areas where their interests collide. It is easy to see why it's in the interest of the two sides to find a way to ease tensions. As he noted at the top of the conversation, President Biden has made clear that China is foreign policy job one for his administration, and driving Beijing and Moscow closer together hardly serves that purpose. Moreover, if the administration can succeed in minimizing Russia's potential spoiler role in places like Ukraine, the Middle East, and elsewhere to make it easier to focus U.S. diplomatic energies on China. Meanwhile, the Russians want Western sanctions relief, and they no doubt recognize that closer relations with China come with a strategic cost. Moscow will always be the junior partner in that relationship. But the big question is, given all of that, do the two sides have the will and the ability to get themselves out of the cul-de-sac they are currently in? And the jury's still out on that.
Yeah, Jim, I'll note on the sanctions front, there was a gesture by the U.S. side in terms of waiving some sanctions related to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I don't think was coincidental coming at the time of this meeting, and I'm sure was noted by the Russians. I mean, is this possibly an area where the U.S. is signaling, hey, you know, we can ease up on this front, we can get into some constructive dialogue with you guys?
Potentially, Bob, but I'm not sure I would make too big a deal of this, because of course, as you mentioned, actually when the meeting was going on, the United States did impose sanctions on some ships and entities involved in the construction of the pipeline. But the decision to waive sanctions on the company behind the pipeline and its chief executive, I think, had a bit more to do with concerns about maintaining good relations with Germany than about trying to create an opening with the Russians.
Got it. And as it pertains to the narrower interest of the Arctic, it seems like they've come up with some common terrain to agree on, although there's a little bit of tensions over the military demilitarization of the Arctic?
I don't think there is a common meeting of the minds on the Arctic. The Russians have made it very clear that they have a very expansive and aggressive plan for the Arctic, and they're warning off all others against treading on what they consider to be their territory. Now, of course, the issue when you talk about the polar cap is, to whom does the territory belong? And there are very sharp disagreements among all of the countries as to how the existing rules of the road apply to the Arctic. And I'll note it's not just the United States disputing Russian claims, but you have a longstanding disagreement between the United States and Canada over their overlapping claims to the Arctic. So it's a pretty complicated thing, and I don't expect it to be resolved anytime soon. And then again, remember, it's not just the countries on the Arctic Ocean littoral who are making claims. You also have countries that have so-called observer status at the Arctic Council, like China, that have a stake and an interest in trying to define what the rules of the road are going to be for the polar ice cap, which it looks like, because of climate change, is going to melt, and at least for big portions of the shipping season, be open to transportation and also potentially the extraction of fossil fuels and other minerals in the seabed.
Now, that last point in particular is important, because that also emerged during these talks, which was new research showing even more rapid melting of that cap and what that means for opening up of shipping lanes, exploitation of resources is going to be really intense.
No doubt about it, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Thailand marks the anniversary of its military coup. Argentina's president speaks on the anniversary of the May Revolution. And Shanghai hosts the annual China International Robot Show.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.